I'm Chris Busby. I'm a researcher in a number of areas of science, but I'm mainly known for research into the health effects of internal radiation. That's the stuff that comes out of nuclear power stations, the stuff that's a consequence of nuclear fission and so on. And I'm talking to you from Latvia because I left England because I felt a bit unsafe after having been arrested by the police as a some sort of terrorist, as a maker of bombs. And lots of people phoned the police station. They didn't have a warrant to break into my house, but anyway, they took me off and threw me in jail. But lots and lots of people phoned up, and so they got scared or somebody called them off or something, so they let me go. But having seen what's happened to Julian Assange and the increasingly sort of right-wing way in which British law is moving, I thought I'd best get out of the country because I'm a significant danger to the military nuclear complex through the research that I do, and they would very much like to just throw me in jail and throw the key away, I think.
Well, most of what we come across when it comes to nuclear isn't military, it's civil nuclear power, and we've got an enormous great power station being built right now in Somerset at Hinkley C. The industry says it's safe, the government says it's safe, but so who are you to disagree?
Well, I've done a great deal of work on the health effects of the Hinkley Power Station, going right back to about 2000 or 1999, when I got hold of data from the Office for National Office for Population Census and Surveys, as it was then, Vital Statistics Unit. I managed to get hold of data on cancer rates by very small areas, by wards. So I was able to look at the ward level cancer around Hinkley Point and show that there were two things that we discovered. One was a doubling in the breast cancer rate around the nuclear power station site. And the second one was there was an increase in infant mortality too, mainly downwind of the site in the wards of Burnham-on-Sea North, where this stuff is just downwind and it gets into the sediment and so on. And then further on from that, I was involved with Cecily Collingridge in a discovery of high levels of enriched uranium around the plant too, which we found in their own reports. So I've had a lot to do with Hinkley Point. Hinkley Point is, like all nuclear power stations, the center of a cluster of child leukemia and high levels of cancer in people who live close by. So I know all about that. I've done a number of other nuclear power station studies as well, one in Bradwell in Essex and then one in Trousvenneth. All of these have been published in the peer review literature some time ago. So yes, of course, nuclear power stations are dangerous, but the main danger that concerned me right from the beginning of my research and which I wrote about in 1995 in my book Wings of Death, which was funded by the Joseph Rowntree Charitable Trust, was the increase in cancer that was predicated by the nuclear weapons fallout, the atmospheric testing that took place all over the world, well, mainly in the Pacific and also in Kazakhstan and Novaya Zemlya and in Nevada, which resulted in the cancer epidemic that everybody now knows about, which began in about 1980. And in a recent paper that I have published last month, I was able to argue that the fallout, that the health fallout of that has involved about 300 million cancers in the lifespan of the people who were exposed from 1959 onwards. That's a lot of dead people, and it rather makes the arguments about the health effects and the fallout from wars like the recent one in the Ukraine, but then before that, you know, Second World War and then the First World War, are really rather dwarfed when we consider the number of people that have died of cancer as a consequence of the fallout from the weapons testing. And of course, as well as that, we have Chernobyl and Fukushima and Sellafield and so on.
The title is Ionizing Radiation and Cancer, the Failure of the Risk Model. Can you take us through some of the main points you're making? Because I'm happy to circulate this, even though it's a scientific paper, Chris, because it's so well written and easy to read. And so can you just take us through some of the main points you're making in it?
I've had great difficulty in getting my message through into the scientific peer review literature. I started to try and do that from about 19, 92 onwards. And I've just been laughed at and attacked on the internet, and papers that I've sent for publication have been automatically rejected, because the message I've been trying to put forward is that the way in which radiation is measured and has been measured right from the beginning is dishonest. Basically, it's dishonest. And what I've been able to do, in fact, this paper was requested. I mean, I was written to. I'm becoming more and more what's the word credible in the last 10 years, and eventually one of the journals wrote to me and said they wanted me to write quite a big review paper about the health effects of radiation, and so I thought, okay, and I did it, and it got published, and this is the one we're talking about. And what I say in there is that right from the very beginning, radiation was measured in a way that was quite reasonable if you're measuring radiation in the environment, but not reasonable if you're measuring radiation in a human being. The idea that was put forward round about the time of the Manhattan Project, when they really started to look at the health effects of internal radiation, that's like plutonium that you swallow or inhale, you know, strontium-90 that you swallow or inhale or eat through the milk where it gets into the milk and so on. That sort of radiation is not the same as the radiation that you get externally from gamma rays and X-rays, because gamma rays and X-rays can be averaged over the whole body. It's like a form of light that goes through you, and the absorption of that dangerous light in the form of ionization is more or less uniform across the whole of your body. And so the method of saying that you can develop this idea for measuring radiation in what's called absorbed dose, and that's how it's done. That's how it's done now. They say your dose is 2 millisieverts, or your dose is 100 millisieverts, or after Chernobyl, nobody got more than 5 millisieverts who lived in Belarus, this sort of thing. So it's always about dose. And dose, from the very beginning, was defined in terms of energy per unit mass. So in other words, you can take the mass of your body, and you can take the energy from the gamma ray and the amount of energy that's absorbed, and you can divide one by the other, and you get dose. And this is a very simple measure, joules per kilogram. So that's the first thing that was done right from the beginning, 1952. So they argued that dose was a measure of radiation effect, and the internal radiation could be measured in the same way. And this was the problem, because internal radiation cannot be measured in the same way, because certain types of internal isotopes, internal radioactive chemicals like strontium-90 and uranium-238, all the uraniums, is that they have a very strong chemical affinity for DNA. And by about 1970, it had become, as a result of a lot of studies of radiation, it became clear that DNA was the target for radiation effects which led to cancer. What radiation did was it caused a mutation in the DNA, and that mutation then continued to get copied to the daughter cells, and copied and copied and copied, until there were so many cells that had the right amount of DNA damage for those cells to go and start to replicate and become cancers. But nothing was done about this. Nobody said, well, obviously internal radiation from strontium-90 is much more dangerous than external radiation at the same dose. And as a result of this, this model became the model that still exists today. And so when they wanted to know the health effects of radiation, they went back and looked at the people who were living in Hiroshima at the time of the Hiroshima bomb. And they started a study in 1952, about 7 years after the bomb exploded. And they started to say, well, you know, the dose of people who were standing closer to the bomb was higher than the dose of people who were standing like 1 kilometer away. And that was lower than the dose of people standing 3 kilometers away. And on the basis of that, they drew a straight line through the cancer yield in this in the people who they had in this lifespan study, which was funded by the Americans. And so on the basis of that, they say we know how many cancers are caused by a certain dose, and that's called the risk model. But that risk model is no good for internal radiation, because a dose from internal radiation from substances which are bound to the DNA through chemical affinity is absolutely enormous, quite clearly so, because the DNA is like the target for the radiation effect. And here you are, you swallow something, and it goes into your bloodstream. It ends up in the DNA on your cells, and then it goes bang. So it blows a hole through the DNA, and then that introduces a mutation, and you go on and get cancer. So this was the essential problem, and this is the essential argument that I laid out in the paper that I just wrote. And the other thing, that of course, that was an earlier paper that I published last year about the Hiroshima study, was to point out that actually it's possible to show quite clearly that most of the cancers that came along after Hiroshima were nothing to do with the external dose. They were to do with the fact that the rain fell after Hiroshima, the black rain, and people got contaminated by the black rain, and it brought down all these particles of uranium, which were particles from the original bomb, and this stuff got into people, and then that was what caused the cancer in the low and medium dose groups. And in fact, the Japanese government was taken to court about a year ago, and they lost the case on this issue. So the Japanese government, and they won't appeal the case, the Japanese government have implicitly agreed that the current risk model is wrong. So the rest of the paper was about the ways in which dishonest scientists and dishonest epidemiologists who've been employed by the nuclear military complex and through universities, groups and so forth, have consistently written dishonest scientific and epidemiological reports, which try to argue that these effects, the dose effects, are very good. They're very well studied, and everybody knows everything to do with radiation now. And the people who think that it's dangerous to live near a nuclear power station are just emotional, and they don't understand science, and all the usual stuff that the anti-nuclear groups get when they stand up and they say, "Hey, look, we don't want to look at we don't want to live near a nuclear site because we're all dying." And they say, "Oh, ha ha. You're not scientists. You don't really understand the science. You don't understand mathematics," and so on. But actually, those people are wrong. They're dishonest scientists. They should all go to jail, in my opinion. But that's what this paper says. What it says is that this risk model is wrong. Now, the consequence of that, the main consequence of that, is that if the risk model is wrong for internal radiation, we have to go back and look to see what's happening to people who've been exposed to internal radiation. Well, of course, people who live downwind of Hinkley Point are exposed to internal radiation because it comes out of the chimneys, the stacks, and it blows across into Burnham-on-Sea North, where we find all these cancer effects, and the same at Trasvenneth in Wales, and the same in Bradwell, and probably the same everywhere, though, you know, time limits the amount of these studies you can do. But the main injection of these radionuclides into the planetary, into the biosphere, was between 1959 and 63, when they were doing all these atmospheric tests in the Pacific and in Russia and in the Nevada test site and New Mexico, Alamogordo. And this produces large quantities of all sorts of completely novel radionuclides, things that had never really existed on Earth before, including concentrated forms of radionuclides like the uranium series, which, although they existed before, were tied up safely in the ground. But then they were, in order to make the bombs, they had to dig them out and refine them and make them pure, then throw them up into the atmosphere and blow them up. So all the stuff then rained down all over the place, got into the food supply, people inhaled it, people ate it, so on, between 1959 and 63. And if we look at the true effects of this and calculate it on a global scale, we can relate these exposures quite easily to the cancer epidemic, which began in about 1979, 1980 in Wales, and about 85, 86 in England, because it starts earlier if you get a bigger contamination. And Wales was much more contaminated because of rainfall. And when we do that, we find the approximate error in the risk model is about 300 to 500 times. And so this cancer epidemic that began in 1980, one that we see now we see one in two people are going to acquire cancer in their lifetime. In the 50s, it was one in nine people. And in the 90s, it was about one in five people. Then it was one in three. Now it's going to be one in two. And nobody says, where does this come from? Nobody says where this comes from. These are age-related increases. So you know, they're age-specific rates. They're not because it's an older population. They are real. They are real. And when you multiply this out over the population of the world, this 30%, 40% increase from the strontium 90 and the uranium and the plutonium and all the rest of that stuff, you get 300 million extra cancers that are absolutely laid at the door of the nuclear military complex and their nuclear testing and their dishonest cover-up of the way in which these things work. They know all this. They absolutely know all this. My friend Bill Pritchard was at the Sizewell inquiry, and he went to the pub with some of these people, and they said, we're told not to talk about internal radiation. And so this has been most of the work that I've done in my life, I suppose. It's been a sort of fanatical obsession of mine, which has led me to work now from 1990 through to, well, I'm still doing it, you know, so...
But I would use the word dogged rather than fanatical. Yes. Anyway. I know that you are sort of presented by some as a sort of maverick figure on the fringes. But I know that actually ever since the Germans split the atom back in the 1930s, there has been, and obviously since the use of the atomic bomb in the Second World War, there has been a whole sort of tradition of scientists who are saying similar things to you. But those people we very rarely hear about. It's almost as if that science has been buried, that science which is extremely critical of any use of nuclear power, or obviously weapons, but particularly of introducing nuclear power as the norm. So can you just tell us about some of your sort of forefathers, in a way, that have done this research right back till Second World War?
Well, the first man to get out and argue about this was a man called Müller, who was a Nobel Prize winner. He was an interesting guy, he was also considered a maverick. But he got a Nobel Prize for being the first person to show that radiation caused genetic damage in fruit flies. He wrote in 1950, he wrote a paper, quite a big paper, about what he considered to be the downstream effect of nuclear testing. He said it was going to be very serious and it was going to introduce a lot of mutations into the human race, which would result in huge levels of cancer. And he was, because of his Nobel Prize status, he was asked to give a talk at the Atoms for Peace conference. And he wrote all this stuff out to talk about it, and then at the last minute they realized what he was saying, and they kicked him out. But I've got the original paper, in fact, which I bought for quite a lot of money, which is in England in my office there. So that was Müller. Then and at that time they didn't even know that the structure of DNA hadn't even been discovered when they put this original risk model together. But he did it from the point of view of fruit flies and genetics and so forth. So then the next person to blow the whistle was another Nobel Prize winner, a Russian, Andrei Sakharov, who was one of the fathers of the Soviet atomic bomb. And he looked at the health effects of internal radiation on the basis of mainly carbon-14, which is another very nasty downstream result of nuclear weapon testing. And he also predicted a huge increase in cancer on the basis of his studies. He's been forgotten too. Then the next man was Linus Pauling, who was the only person to have two Nobel Prizes, and also used to wear a beret, I have to say. So Linus Pauling wrote a lot of stuff about nuclear testing, and he used to march in anti-nuclear marches and so on. We're talking in the 60s now. And he said there was going to be a massive downstream health effect, lots of cancers and so on. Then we have Ernest Sternglass from Pittsburgh, who was a friend of mine. All these guys are dead now. I'm sort of like the last of the Mohicans. So he looked at infant mortality effects, and he showed there was an enormous increase in perinatal and infant mortality around about the time of the testing. Millions of children died over that period as a result of these radionuclides. In the 50s, there was also Dr. Alice Stewart, who got attacked by everybody, and she showed that very small x-rays to the fetus, you know, to mothers, obstetric x-rays, caused a 10% increase in childhood cancer. There were John Goffman was another one. He used to be he was the man who discovered plutonium, or worked on plutonium and various isotopes, the new isotopes. As he worked for the Atomic Energy Commission, and then he got kicked out. Then there was Ed Radford, who was the head, who I also knew. He was the head of the Biological Effects of Ionizing Radiation Committee of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. He said they were all a bunch of crooks, and they kicked him out. He had to come and live in England. I can go on. But they're all dead, these people, all of them. Carl Morgan, the father of health physics, the man who started the investigations into internal radiation. He was the chair of Committee 2 of the International Commission on Radiological Protection. He said that in a book that he wrote in 1996, he said, "I feel like a father ashamed of his children." So there are lots and lots of people who've said all this. But of course, the point is, as you know, Tony, the media is controlled. And in the area of radiation and cancer, the media is unbelievably controlled. And anybody who comes along and tries to sell the message that I've been selling over the last 30 years is just get laughed at and put into the category of what you were saying, you know, some sort of like mad fringe lunatic person who doesn't really know what he's doing. But that's changing now. You know, I'm getting my papers now into serious peer-reviewed literature. When I was first doing this, they just laughed at me.
This is one thing I'd just like to pick up on, because you're saying that, oh, you know, they're selling their thing, you're selling yours, but you're actually not selling, Chris. Can I just say, you're not. You're actually having to pay, you were telling me recently, to get your papers into the peer-reviewed literature.
Well, that's generally true. You have to pay to do that. But since I haven't got any money, it was quite good that these people wrote to me and they said, well, we're going to not charge you anything. That the cost, the page cost, the publication cost from that journal is $1,700. And they said, we'll do it for free because we want to hear what you say. So wow. This sort of happens. People write to me all the time and they say, can I publish a paper with them because I'm getting quite famous? And I say, look, no, I can't, because I can't afford to pay for bloody page cost. You know, I mean, I'm on some miserable pension living in Latvia. And anyway, I don't see why I should. That's the other thing about it. I mean,
you know. Anyway, look, you said you think things might be changing. Why is that?
Well, because people are asking me for papers. That's why. I mean, I get emails all the time from journals saying, will you publish a paper in my journal? And so I do, so long as they don't charge me.
Does that imply that the policy might change?
I think it does. I think it means to me that there are enough scientists out there now who realize that this risk model that is there at the moment is a load of nonsense and dishonestly put together, you know, and that message is coming across. And so I think that, if you like, it's a sort of Berlin Wall moment at the moment. I think this is all going to go down.
Well, that's certainly an interesting challenge. But look, if you look at, for example, the Scottish Green Party here, they have actually embraced nuclear. They're saying, well, we won't be calling for the shutdown of nuclear power stations. We have decided we're going to embrace the extension of the life of nuclear power. So this is something very interesting in the Green movement, that it started out as an environmental movement. It's now basically embracing nuclear. What is going on there?
I gave up on the Green Party in about 2005. The original Green Party that I was in, the sort of like, you know, the unwashed, dreadlocked kind of like, if you like, loonies, you know, those clever people, they were basically squeezed out. And the Green Party was taken over by, I guess he was called right wingers. I did an ideological questionnaire on the Green Party round about that time. And I found that they were moving more and more to a kind of realpolitik view of the world. So, you know, if they wanted power, and they realized that the only way they could get power was by pretending to be like everybody else. And that's kind of what's happened. And after Monbiot, I got attacked by Monbiot in The Guardian, and I wasn't given permission to reply. The Greens all ran away from me as fast as they could go. I was science and technology speaker for the Green Party in 2006, And then they immediately kicked me out, and I've had very little to do with them since then. I noticed the other day that the German Green Party foreign minister, and how she was supporting all this kind of Zelensky Ukrainian sort of send them lots of bomb type money stuff. I don't really have a lot of time for the Green Party. I mean, they're not the party that I knew. They're something else. And I don't really sort of trust them, to be honest.
Well, look, what we've seen in the UK is Boris Johnson announcing a whole new raft of these mini nuclear power stations, mini nuclear plants built by Rolls Royce. And we are seeing increasingly people like Extinction Rebellion, the campaign which the guy you mentioned, George Monbiot, is a major ideologue for, also embracing nuclear and certainly not campaigning against it, saying that actually we need to reduce the use of fossil fuels in our energy, and that nuclear is one of the great, brilliant assets for the future, because unlike the solar and wind power, it doesn't fluctuate. You know, you can have your nuclear power station on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and it will keep chucking out lots and lots of energy, which is carbon neutral, apparently. So what do you make of this whole new energy policy, which Boris and Extinction Rebellion seem to be aligned on, and Prince Charles?
Well, I'll tell you one thing about it that I do know, and that is that these mini reactors, which are basically submarine reactors, are very unshielded, and they're leaky, and they produce all sorts of radionuclides. They produce much more radioactive contamination than the standard big ones like Hinkley Point. Okay, so they are very, very dangerous. I'm doing a court case in Scotland about one of these things, on behalf of a lady whose husband was killed by one of these things, who got lymphoma, and those people who live on who work on ships that are propelled by these reactors have about a tenfold excess of cancer relative to the normal population. I mean, I wrote a paper about that that was published in quite a prestigious journal about 2 years ago, looking at the U.S. Navy personnel who worked on ships that were nuclear powered. Well, those are the same things. Those nuclear power engines for the ships are what Rolls-Royce are producing, and they're going to wheel out into all the communities in order to give them very cheap electricity. I'm not denying that they produce electricity. It's not so cheap, incidentally, and they're certainly not carbon neutral because of the cost of getting rid of all of the nuclear waste at the end of the day, and the cost of mining the uranium in the first place. And incidentally, a lot of the uranium used in nuclear reactors comes from Russia. So with the restrictions on that, the people with nuclear power stations are having a lot of problems fueling their systems. But look, I mean, if you're going to have democracy, then the people have to be able to decide. If they want to have mini nuclear reactors and die of cancer, well, then that's their choice. You know, it's a sort of balance. It's like you say, we'd rather have a nuclear reactor and have a high cancer rate than freeze to death in winter because we can't get gas or whatever it is.
Yeah, but there's been no discussion about this being something which is going to bring in a high cancer rate, Chris, at all.
No, of course there isn't, because they have this risk model that I'm attacking. That's the point. On the basis of the risk model and on the basis of the nonsense that they tell you about reactors, they don't leak at all. There's no way of getting a radiation exposure to a reactor because they're absolutely sealed up and they don't leak. Everything is perfectly safe. And even if you did get a small dose from the reactor, it wouldn't give you any cancer, because the risk model tells you that in order to get cancer, you have to basically stand in front of an atom bomb. Like Hiroshima atom bomb, 1 kilometer away. So it's an enormous. The whole thing is an enormous theater, in which people are fooled by idiots like Monbiot and that other guy. Can't remember his name now. Who wrote a book about this? The Green Party is fooled. So the trouble is, Green Party are not scientists. You know, when I was in the Green Party, even then, there were no scientists. Nobody questioned the science. They're all very, very clever people, but they are humanities people. They're people who know about history and about sociology and philosophy and all that stuff. But when it comes to numbers, they're no good. And they have to swallow the guff that's given to them by some But who says he knows about numbers? But Monbiot knows nothing about numbers. Monbiot is just completely ignorant of science. I mean, I've read his books. They're the books of an ignoramus, all right? And I don't trust the man anyway. Mark Linus, that's the other guy. Which he's another guy. He's not a scientist either. And these people don't. They just sit down, they write a book, and they write more or less what they like, and everybody swallows it.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. I knew both of those two when I was living in Oxford years ago, and Mark went to work for something called One World. He got a very high-paid job, and everyone, I suppose, this is slightly a prejudicial comment, but thought, well, the guy's just sold out because he was a sort of follower of the environmental movement, but he didn't really seem to – he seemed to think, you know, actually it was a way to just get yourself a job in somewhere and to toe the line, really. Anyway, look, the philosophy, though, behind Extinction Rebellion seems to me to be a sort of – almost a kind of fake green. What do you think the real evidence is that we need to – bring in this nuclear? Because there's a very good argument, as I said just now, which says that in order to, if you're going to get rid of fossil fuels, number one, I mean, we may question that, but if you're going to do that, you've got to have something which will take on the base load of electricity throughout the country. And nuclear really seems to be the only thing that will fit the bill.
Well, that could be so, and I wouldn't argue against that. But what I do say is that we do not need all that energy. That's the point. I mean, if you look at what we might loosely call the capitalist system, you know, and think about the things that are done there, think about the inefficiencies of use of energy and the enormous amount of energy that is used manufacturing things that nobody needs. All we need to do is reset the way in which the world works in terms of buying and selling. You walk down any high street and you look through any window and you see what they're selling and you think, well, somebody's had to make that thing. Somebody's had to produce all that. There has to be a factory. And so a lot of this stuff is not even needed. And the stuff that isn't needed, they sell you using advertising, which takes a lot of other energy as well. The wastage of energy in if you like to call it the last days of Earth, which is kind of what I'm thinking about these days, is absolutely monstrous. They just throw it all away. You could spend money on efficiently insulating houses, and you could spend money on those sorts of things that human beings absolutely need, you know, like sewage disposal. And, well, you can write it all out, you know. And if you did that, you would find – and cars. I mean, what about car manufacturers? I mean, the enormous numbers of cars that are wasted and driven and burn their way through fuel all the time. Anyway, it's easy to write down a possible world. Even a child could write down a possible world where you just don't write down the things that people need, you know, comfort and love and housing and food and water, those sorts of things. And everything else really is just unnecessary. You can just put it all to one side. And then the amount of energy needed is much less than is enough. You know, we have enough energy at the moment to run that sort of world, but it's not that sort of world. Think of the amount of energy that goes into producing missiles.
Yeah. Also, with Hinkley Point, Chris, I wonder if you could just give us what you make of that. We're being told here at Hinkley C that EDF is saying that the war in Ukraine and shortages are set to delay Hinkley C again, so that it won't be starting until 2026 at the earliest.
Well, my prediction is that it will never be built. I think the world is moving very fast now into a completely new scenario, you know, as a result of Russia. Basically, what Russia is doing is cutting down the domination, the dominance of the United States in terms of the dollar. That's basically what Putin's plan is, and I think he's going to succeed. And the rest of it is all theater. It's all Hollywood. So I don't think that anybody's going to be building those big nuclear power stations. I think that the world is changing rapidly.
Yeah, we did have an indication, didn't we, from China with a reactor of an identical design that had to close down after about 8 months of operating due to faults. And this is a brand new design, which is basically untested.
I think all of these proposals to build nuclear power stations and all of the theatre that goes with it are basically there in order to increase the the investment into the companies that are doing these things. I don't think any of them really think they're ever going to build anything. I mean, they're just dragging their heels and building what they can.
Hang on. I mean, how can you plough so much money? I mean, we're talking about many billions into the Hinkley project with no return at the end of it. How can you do that? It's impossible, surely. It doesn't make sense.
It's not impossible. You can certainly do it. It's a sort of, Ponzo scheme, you know? You just get people to invest. Companies invest, these people invest, those people invest. I mean, the lobbyists for government will tell government that you need to have, you need to have energy, and we're going to build this enormous power station that's going to, just like from the very beginning, it's just going to produce so much electricity you can hardly even bother to pay for it and blah, blah, blah. It's a sort of capitalist scheme. It's a venture.
And so you think maybe anyway. So look, I can't not ask you about Ukraine, Chris, because you're over there in Latvia. Apparently, quite a lot of NATO troops turning up in the Baltic states, yeah. Lithuania and Estonia. Yeah. So what do you make of what's going on? Are people in Latvia pleased to see all these NATO soldiers turning up to protect them from Russia?
Well, what's happened in Latvia is that the newspapers, who have been influenced by basically the British, have been trying to frighten the population of Latvia into believing that the Russians are just about to walk over the border and take control of Latvia, like they walked over the border and tried to take control of Ukraine. And so there's a sort of hysteria here that's produced by the media. Also in all of these countries, in Sweden, in Finland, in Lithuania, and Poland, and so on. And so the story that is sold is that Putin is off his head and he wants to reestablish the Soviet Union, which I don't believe is the case at all. I used to write for RT, and I know various people that tell me things about the situation and what's going on and so forth. Of course, I may be wrong. I have 100% belief that Putin is not going to attack the Baltic states. Putin's operation is essentially an economic one. It's one that started out protecting the eastern part of the Ukraine from attacks which are increasingly happening from the Ukrainians, and the Ukrainian side were being, what's the word, they're being encouraged to attack the Donbass by the United States by NATO. NATO is the United States, and so they wanted to produce a situation where they could take down Putin, but it seems to have backfired. Of course, war is horrible, and I mean, what's happened there is absolutely terrible. All the deaths and so forth. I mean, that is war. But that war was, in my opinion, produced by NATO. The pressure was for so big that Putin basically had to go in there and protect the eastern side. But at the same time, his plan, and he's a clever guy in my opinion, his plan was to destroy the dollar. He's been up for destroying the dollar for a long time, and it looks like it's working. They did all these sanctions, and that guy Biden said that the sanctions were working and they destroyed the ruble and all this stuff. But anybody can go online to see that he's done nothing of the sort, and that the ruble is now stronger than it was before the war. So all Putin has to do now is sit on his hands and wait for Ukraine to collapse, which I think it will have to do, because all the heavy weaponry that's supposedly coming from America and from Britain and now from Germany will not get to the battle site, because that's about 1,000 kilometers away, and Putin has just destroyed all of the roads and the railways, so it's not possible to get there. You hear quite a lot different on on RT and so on, and other that what you see is that the sort of saber rattling nonsense from the American media is just that. It's just theater. And what you see also is you see Zelensky in his T-shirt, you know, acting, which is what he is. He's just an actor, you know, acting this all out in some kind of crazy theater. But it's not real. None of it's real. It's all Hollywood. There was an interesting film that I saw recently, incidentally. Other people should look at this. It's called Wag the Dog. It was produced in about 1998, Wag the Dog. And it's about how the Americans produced the television war in order to get the president off the hook. So people should watch that, because it's exactly what's happening in the Ukraine. The Ukraine is entirely Hollywood.
Well, you say that, and you talk about saber rattling, but you know, the other side of the research which you've done, of course, is the nuclear weapons. Do you think there's any real possibility that this could go there? Because some of the commentators are saying, actually, the Cuban Missile Crisis was largely theatrical, that the Americans needed it to save face after they'd agreed to pull their nuclear weapons out of Turkey. And so the Russians and the Americans had basically agreed this was going to happen, but they had to have this kind of big hoo-ha in the press so that the Americans would say, oh, we did the right thing, rather than just look like they climbed down in front of the Soviets. And some of the commentators now, Chris, are saying that the potential for sort of hair trigger to trigger even an accidental use of a nuclear weapon could be like a house of cards.
I agree. It's very dangerous. It's very, very dangerous and very worrying. And I'm asked all the time to check on the background levels of radiation, you know, in case somebody starts using a nuclear weapon. If there's a total exchange, it will be pretty awful. It'll be like Mad Max territory. I don't think there will be, but you know, it is touch and go, because like you say, it could be just a mistake. You know, somebody could just, because everybody is on edge, and there could be some error. And then,
well, I mean, that's right. There is some quite good literature around about near nuclear misses over the years, where, for example, the United States was about to launch aircraft equipped with nuclear air-to-air missiles, if you can believe that. And that was all caused by a bear which had actually managed to breach the fence. Now, you couldn't make it up, really, the Russian bear, but they believed that this was actually Russian infantry that were about to invade their base. The Americans nearly launched this force, and it took the base commander himself, who'd found out what had actually happened after they'd been given the order to go, to drive out in his car onto the main runway in order to stop the first aircraft launching from the threshold of the runway. So sometimes these sorts of things can be a little bit, you know, almost once someone says go, it can be very difficult to stop, as we know, of course, from Dr. Strangelove, the film. So final question, do you think it's going to last a long time, this Ukraine thing, or do you think it could be over fairly shortly?
I think it's going to last certainly a few months. It might be over after that. I don't think it's going to last for the rest of the year. It's going to in my opinion, it's going to result in a sort of North Korea, South Korea situation where there's some kind of border. My concern is Poland, I have to say. I think there's something going on in Poland and Lithuania which might change the whole direction of the argument. The Poles used to own the Ukraine, you see. It used to be, I mean, if you go right back to the time of the Bolsheviks, when Ukraine suddenly started, I mean, before that, it was just a lot of different people. But if you read The White Guard by Bulgakov, he writes very accurately and at the time about what was happening in the Ukraine at that point. And the Poles and the Lithuanians, they owned that part of Western Ukraine, and I think they want to get it back. So the Polish people are making all sorts of noises about brotherhood and friendship with Western Ukraine. So it could be that there will be an Eastern Ukraine, which is Russian speaking, and a Western Ukraine, which is Ukrainian and Polish speaking, as a sort of result of all of this stuff. God only knows about the nuclear aspect. That does worry me. I mean, if Sweden and Finland become members of NATO, they will be flying these American bombers that can carry this B-31 nuclear bomb, and then of course Putin will have to bring a load of missiles to the border, and so we will be a border country. What will happen here is that we'll become very rich, because everyone will come here and we'll be like a frontline state, and all the prices of everything will go up, etc., etc., etc. I mean, I tell you what worries me, Tony, is that all of my life I've tried to run away from this stuff, and wherever I go, it follows me. You wouldn't have thought that I'd come all the way to Latvia and go and live in a forest, and suddenly Latvia is the front line against the Russian nuclear weapons.
Anyway, one of the nice things about all this is there is a quite switched on younger generation out there, Chris. And I wonder if anyone is interested.
I hope so.
I think there is. You know, I meet quite a lot of youngsters that don't take what they are fed without criticising it, that they're very critical of the media, critical of governments, and untrusting of the things that we're circulated as facts. For example, things, you know, I'm talking about basic stuff like the September 11th attacks, Iraq war, all these things. And I wonder, say, if there are any of those youngsters listening or parents of them, if they were interested in taking, getting involved and, measuring nuclear activity, for radiation, is there a sort of reasonably inexpensive, I don't know, would be a Geiger counter, I guess, or something, which is
you can get a lot of cheap Geiger counters, but basically, unless there's a nuclear war, they're not going to tell you very much. If you get there's one called the Inspector, which you can use, which is quite a good one. It's got the standard pancake detector, and that's about the cheapest good one that you can get, but it's about £300-400. But yes, you can measure radiation with that, and you can do all of that stuff. Since Chernobyl, there have been detector maps that you can get through what's called EURADOS. If you look in EURDOS, and you can find the gamma radiation levels measured by this outfit in nearly every part of Europe, including the UK. So you can, if you don't need a Geiger count, you could just look at this stuff and see what's happening.
It's quite nice to have a Geiger counter if you can afford it, because this is something which is invisible. It may be there, it may not be. Say, for example, you're one of the people in Bridgewater that lives next door to the railhead where the nuclear waste is transferred, right next to a whole load of social housing. Literally right next door, it might be quite nice for someone down there to be able to go and see, is there actually any radiation? And can you just give us a really brief, because there are these three different types of radiation, alpha, beta and gamma. Give us a bit of a sort of, idiot's guide to what's the difference between those three.
All right. Well, alpha radiation is very difficult to measure because it's very short range. And it doesn't go through the window of the Geiger counter. So forget alpha radiation. You need a special thing called a scintillation counter, and they're jolly expensive. But beta and gamma will both be detectable by a reasonable Geiger counter. The key is not to get something with a very small detector, because you won't find anything. So you've got to have a detector that's big enough and sensitive enough for environmental radiation. The ones that will fit into a mobile phone and plug into a mobile phone are waste of time. So what you need is something like there's some Russian ones that are about £200, which work, anything that's about £200 that's got a reasonably good Geiger counter detector system will work. But if it were me and I really wanted to do it seriously, I'd get this thing called the Inspector, which is about the size of a big mobile phone, I suppose. No, maybe bigger than that. It's about the size of a beta cam tape, one of those big video tapes that you used to get, All right. So that measures beta and it measures gamma. You can distinguish between the two by putting a piece of copper sheet, thin copper sheet, between the Geiger counter and what you're measuring, and then you can then that'll stop the beta, so you can then subtract that from the total signal to get the gamma. But the great thing about this is that if you're measuring samples like mud or something like that, what you can do is you can measure them over a period of time. So you just get the Geiger counter and you press start on it, and you wait about 5 minutes and press stop. Then you can actually measure the radiation content of foods or soil samples or more or less anything you like, and that's a very useful way to go forward, because you can say, well, this carrot is more radioactive than that potato. On that level, and around Hinkley Point, that's going to be the case. This carrot is going to be more radioactive than that potato, because lots of stuff comes out of Hinkley Point and ends up on the beach and ends up in the mud along the River Parrot, particularly.
Can you just give us a website or whatever people and your most recent books? And I will also include with this week's show a copy of this paper that you've done.
Okay, good. Well, the best thing to do is to go to Green Audit, www.greenaudit.org. And the other one is the Low Level Radiation Campaign, www.llrc.org. Richard Bramhall runs the Low Level Radiation Campaign, and most of what I do he puts up there. And also go to my Facebook page, because I stick everything I do up on my Facebook page, and people often, you know, write and argue about something or another, and I write back. I mean, my message to the Green Party is that they're going down the wrong road, and they've been fooled by people like Monbiot and Linus, who are not what they seem.
And the nice thing about a Geiger counter, you know, this is one of the great things about it, is it would be awful, wouldn't it, if you switched a Geiger counter on and then nothing happened. You feel like you've been kind of cheated somehow. But even it picks up the background radiation, so you get a few ticks away, tick, tick, ticks away.
Yeah, sure.
What you could do is you can get excited as those ticks start to increase, that, crikey, look, we've got some real radiation here.
You can do that, yeah, sure. You've got to be careful that there are some naturally radioactive things, you know, like Tilly mantles. You know, there's thorium mantles that you use for light, for Coleman lanterns and that sort of thing. They're jolly radioactive, they are.
Well shouldn't be selling them, surely, if they're radioactive, should they?
Well, no, but that's the point. On the basis of the dose model that they talk about, they say that they're safe. But you put that next to a Geiger counter, it'll go through the roof.
Okay, well, that's a good way to test to see if it's working. All right, Chris Busby, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, Tony, cheers.